Now, this fall, many kids playing sports are likely to suffer injuries. It's typical. One way to improve fitness and avoid injuries is weight training. That's right, weight training for kids. NPR's Patty Naiman reports.
Forget the image of the muscle-bound man or woman straining and sweating under a metal barbell with 40, 50, or even hundreds of pounds of weight on either side.
Stand up nice and tall. Good. Hold that ball out. 20 seconds.
Jared Guerrero is 7 years old. With sturdy legs planted firmly on the floor, Jared's arms are straight out in front of his very determined-looking face. He holds a ball that looks sort of like a soccer ball, only this ball weighs 4 pounds.
Hold it above the head. Good. A little bit longer on this one. Pull that belly button to the spine.
At Velocity Sports Performance in West Los Angeles, sports trainer Brock Christopher takes Jared through his paces, sprints and dashes, push-ups, sit-ups, squats, and also weights.
We'll do 12. Ready, bring the ball up? Ready, and go, and touch. One.
This is pretty much the 7-year-old version of weightlifting. No metal bar or 100-pound plates. The rubber ball Jared works with is called a medicine ball. They became popular 100 years ago for fitness work and rehab with the elderly. Trainer Brock Christopher.
The whole joy of a medicine ball is we can do 10 million different things with it.
Years ago, weightlifting got a bad rap, says pediatric exercise researcher Avery Fagenbaum, who teaches exercise science at the College of New Jersey. Kids were doing bodybuilding in home basements, he says, lifting weights and hurting themselves either because the weights were too heavy or they dropped them. At the time, concerns were also raised about whether weight-bearing exercise was good for growing kids. Fagenbaum says weightlifting with barbells can be safe for kids, but they have to be very closely supervised. Medicine balls are simpler, he says. They're less expensive and safer. Even if kids drop them, they're unlikely to hurt themselves. Fagenbaum adds that today's research shows weightlifting can even help build strong bones.
Weight-bearing physical activity is absolutely essential for building bone. And some people say the years of childhood and early adolescence, maybe under age 14 or so, are the ideal times to build bone. And if you miss out on this window of opportunity, you may never get it back.
During exercise with a medicine ball, for example, the muscles pull on the bone during every push and pull. In response to that stimulus, bone-building cells migrate to the bone surface and actually start making new bone. Fagenbaum says Olympic weightlifters have levels of bone mineral density well above their non-weightlifting counterparts. Even simple day-to-day exercises, he says, can build bone.
When you perform hopscotch or jumping jacks, every hop and every skip and every jump, the bone bends just a little bit. And that bend stimulates growth. And over time, that's exactly what we want.
And for overweight kids, resistance training can reduce the amount of actual fat by increasing the amount of muscle. Most important, though, says Fagenbaum, routine physical activity early on can prepare kids for a lifetime of exercise with all its cardiovascular and disease prevention benefits. One footnote, however, Fagenbaum says exercise has to be made fun for kids, something sports trainer Brock Christopher knows well.
We also test them on state capitals. And watch this. See, this is how smart he is. Florida.
Tallahassee.
Connecticut.
Hartford.
Maine.
Augusta.
My home state, Idaho.
Boise.
See? Unbelievable.
And now, back to push-ups. Patty Naiman, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We're going to talk next about a story we haven't heard enough about this year. Now, you may feel like you've heard plenty about American efforts in Afghanistan in recent weeks.
Tonight, a closer look at the daily slog there and the hard-won
province. What followed was a 3-day pitched battle.
This is the one commercial hub, and the Taliban have been controlling it.
That was NBC, ABC, and NPR, respectively. Yet, as NPR's David Folkenflik reports, in many major media outlets, the conflict in Afghanistan has not been a particularly high-profile story.
The real question is why you haven't seen and heard a lot more coverage, given that we've been fighting a war there for years and all. I asked Mark Jerkowitz to run some numbers on the media's handling of Afghanistan this year. He's the associate director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. Jerkowitz looked at his database and found the economy was a much bigger story since January 1st. That makes sense. Iraq, too. The elevation of Judge Sonia Sotomayor to the U.S. Supreme Court got roughly the same amount of media as Afghanistan this year. Okay. But so did this.
Late news from Los Angeles. The L.A. Times is reporting that pop star Michael Jackson has died.
That year-long comparison is all the more striking because Jackson's death only occurred in late June. Remember, there are now 62,000 troops in Afghanistan, and more may well be on the way.
You know, this is not just another war in some godforsaken place on the other side of the world.
Human rights investigator John Sifton has traveled to the country repeatedly, and he says it warrants much more careful attention.
This is a place that has direct relationship to the events of the morning of September 11th and our ongoing security down the line.
But when the Bush administration shifted its attention to Iraq, so did the media and the public.
It's a tough sell for readers and viewers and listeners because they think about the economy, they think about Iraq. Iraq steals a lot of the oxygen. And, you really need to try to get people to care about this. It's not easy.
Meanwhile, the situation in Afghanistan has deteriorated. And since taking office, President Obama has increased the American involvement there. That caught the eye of the Washington Post, where Liz Spade is a managing editor.
Just like Iraq was Bush's war, Afghanistan is Obama's war.
Spade says the newspaper has significantly increased its resources in covering Afghanistan, mirroring the administration's investment.
I'm sure it's going to be an issue that in part defines Obama's presidency as much as any foreign policy issue.
So there has been an uptick in coverage, but there are three things worth remembering about the challenges in reporting on Afghanistan. First, it's complicated. Former CNN and NBC reporter Jane Arraf was last there in 2002. She now reports for the Christian Science Monitor and is planning to return this fall.
It's dozens, if not hundreds, of small countries, essentially, that you're trying to cover. In Afghanistan, there's so much below the surface that I think most of us, myself included probably, aren't even aware of how little we know about it.
Second, it's dangerous. New York Times reporter David Rode was kidnapped by the Taliban and held for more than 7 months. A photographer for the Associated Press lost his foot this month after being badly wounded by a roadside bomb. Third, it's expensive. Here's Mark Jerkowitz of the Project for Excellence in Journalism.
This is a time when news organizations are literally fighting for their survival. They're in bankruptcy court. In that kind of environment, the idea of being able to spend money to send journalists in a smaller newsroom overseas becomes not just a luxury, but almost an impossibility.
Jerkowitz's former employer, the Boston Globe, is among the big regional dailies that cut or eliminated foreign coverage. The Wall Street Journal doesn't have a permanent Afghanistan bureau, nor does the 30-daily McClatchy newspaper chain, though both news outlets send reporters there regularly. And that's how the big three broadcast networks handle it, too. And it shows. I looked at the network evening newscasts. They averaged about one story every 2 weeks for the year ending July 31st. Far more coverage has been generated by the New York Times, NPR, and the Associated Press, which, along with the Washington Post, all have permanent bureaus in Afghanistan. The Post's Liz Spade.
I think we're trying to do everything we can to draw people into the story. But like I say, I think there's a lot of other factors that are at work that just compete for people's time.
So you can find the news if you're willing to look. And the coverage has intensified. According to the Project for Excellence in Journalism, it's gone from 1% of all news coverage last year to 2% so far this year. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
The spread of swine flu is also on the minds of many airport officials around the world. But it seems that at one major air hub, literature and philosophy are also front and center. London's Heathrow Airport is paying writer Alain de Botton to spend a week at the new Terminal 5 and write about what he sees. He'll publish his work in a book this fall and hand out 10,000 copies to travelers passing through the terminal. Alain de Botton is on the line from Heathrow. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Yes, can you hear me?
I can. Well, where are you right now?
So I'm now inside the main operations room for the terminal, which has all the banks of computers which show things like passenger flow, any security incidents flash up here, and that sort of thing.
So you just sort of wander around Terminal 5 at will?
That's right, and around the whole airport, actually. I've got access to pretty much anything from the control tower to the catering facility to, you know, the engineering sheds. That's part of the deal that really I'm allowed anywhere.
I've seen you referred to as the writer in residence at Heathrow for the week and as the philosopher in residence at Heathrow. Which do you prefer?
I think it is technically the writer in residence. Mm.
What is expected of you as the writer in residence?
Well, I mean, this is something that initially, the concern really was, what am I going to be allowed to say? And are there limits to what I can say? I think everybody's realized that this is absolutely not going to work if there's any form of censorship. I mean, I've got a regular publishing deal with a regular publisher, and the text that I write will just go to the publisher without even being shown to Heathrow. Mm. So it's full editorial control, which is, I think, the only way that one can do it, because otherwise it just becomes a piece of marketing. And I told them, you know, fairly and squarely that I'm undoubtedly going to say some things they don't like.
And so it's sort of this impressionistic experience where you can kind of just write about the things that you're seeing?
I think, you know, many of us find airports fascinating. They are in many ways the kind of cultural centers of the modern world. They express all the things that make the modern world so strange and horrifying and beautiful and exciting. They're all about interconnection. They're about technology. They're about our lack of contact or loss of contact with nature. They're about consumerism. They're about the dreams of travel. All of this kind of comes to life at the airport. These things that could otherwise sound like abstractions become real at the airport.
Have you made friends there so far during your week at the
I have actually. I'm friendly with the cleaner of my section, who's she's Romanian from Transylvania, and she very much wants to be in my book. But she said that if I do put her in, she needs all her details changed, because otherwise it would disappoint many of her friends in Romania who think that she's got a brilliant career in classical music, which in fact she doesn't, because she's cleaning the floor. So they're full of stories that are kind of poignant and touching and complex, and you know, they're many people's lives that just don't fit the easy categories in that airport.
What's the most unexpected thing you've seen so far?
The one really unexpected thing, I was approached by the head of baggage. He's like number three in the organization. He's got a big job. He came along and he was hilarious. He sat down at the desk next to me and said, "I can't take it. I am fed up. I want to see a tree. I have not seen a tree in so long. I'm going to go mad." I said, "How do you mean a tree?" He goes, "I work in the bowels of this building, and I want to see a tree." You know, he's at the center of the most technological system of probably the most modern airport in the world, this terminal, and it's driving him nuts. So that was kind of an interesting confession.
Can you read a little bit of what you've written so far?
Absolutely. So this is a little bit where I was writing. I noticed some lovers. Airports are full of moments of parting, of course. Some lovers were parting. She must have been 20, he a few years older. Haruki Murakami's Norwegian Wood was in her bag. They had oversized sunglasses and had come of age in the period between SARS and swine flu. They were dressed casually in combat trousers and T-shirts. It was the intensity of their kiss that first attracted my attention. But what had seemed like passion from afar was revealed at closer range to be unusual devastation.
You know, Hélène de Botton, we're having a competition on our show, 3-Minute Fiction, and I think that you might very well be a finalist with that. That's
yes,
a great...
Once I get back to civilian life, I'd like to have a go.
Writer Hélène de Botton is a commentator for All Things Considered, and for this week only, the writer in residence at London's Heathrow Airport. Hélène de Botton, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
NPR's business news starts with optimism in Asian markets. Leading indices in the region are mostly higher, with Tokyo up more than 3%. Investors were buoyed in part by news out of the U.S. On Friday, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke said, "The prospects for growth in the near term appear good." And those few words carried through the weekend. As well, Asia's own economies are looking better.
In China, the Shanghai market rose largely because of big gains in the stock price of a big oil refiner called Sinopec. It is the world's second largest oil refiner after ExxonMobil, and yesterday it announced record profits. This comes at a time when energy prices are rising. Bear this in mind for its impact on your gas tank or your home heating oil. Oil is now trading at more than $74 per barrel, back up to $74, even though the economy is not exactly roaring. Oil market investors are bidding up prices because of optimism about the global economy's future. An economic recovery would boost demand. Although natural gas prices are falling, they are now at a 7-year low. That is because of a glut in supplies.
56 million children are heading back to school this fall. It's shaping up to be a year when schools face more demands with fewer resources. We asked three reporters to tell us about the challenges confronting schools in their areas. We hear first from Seattle and Jennifer Wing of member station KPLU.
The Seattle School District had to plug a $34 million deficit. It closed schools, ended programs, and laid off more than 100 teachers. Superintendent Maria Goodloe-Johnson made this promise.
Our goal is to provide for parents a stronger school and a stronger system and stronger choices.
A lot of parents are not impressed. Dora Taylor is the mother of a 16-year-old high school student.
She's not strengthening anything. She's dividing it and weakening the system.
Taylor is angry. Her daughter's alternative school called Nova was closed. It was a place for teens that don't do well in a traditional classroom setting. Losing the school is sad for Taylor and her daughter, but it could be worse. Students and teachers will be able to stay together. Their new home is an old middle school. Nova will be sharing the space with another program that supports immigrant children. On this day, Taylor visits the new site. The doors are locked, so she presses her nose against the glass to get a better look inside.
Oh my gosh. Not even maintenance came and cleaned up. So we're moving into a mess of a building on top of everything else.
The district promises everything will be in order by September 9th, the first day of school. Not everyone is unhappy with the changes being made.
My principal came to me and said they had only put 27 students in my classroom for this coming year, and then now it has dwindled down to, I think, 21 or 22.
That's Lisa Bilson. She's a kindergarten teacher at Laurelhurst Elementary. She normally has at least 30 5- and 6-year-olds in her class, but not this year. With all the restructuring going on, a school up the road was repurposed from K through 12 and is now for students in kindergarten through the 8th grade only. That means more elementary spaces there takes the pressure off of Bilson's classroom.
I feel like with less kids, I might be able to loosen up a little or have a little more fun.
The good times for Bilson might not last for long. Even though the federal stimulus money has made it possible for the district to hire back many of the teachers it laid off, the financial forecast for the next 2 years is pretty gloomy. The district is just getting started on the next budget, which is already $10 to $15 million in the red. More cuts will have to be made, and everything is on the table. For NPR News, I'm Jennifer Wing.
I'm Greg Allen in Miami. School opens today for more than 300,000 students in the nation's fourth largest school district. Even though it's the middle of an economic recession, officials here have so far largely avoided big cuts. They've done it by judiciously trimming and aggressively lobbying for federal help in the form of stimulus money. At Palmetto Senior High School in the Miami suburb of Pinecrest, there are few signs of a funding crisis. Even before the school year began, the marching band was already rehearsing, and leaders of student activities groups were meeting to make plans for the upcoming school year. In the administrative office, Harry Nurnberg is helping students and parents register for school. He's been a guidance counselor since he fell into the job as a young teacher working at his first school.
One of the counselors got sick, and the principal asked me to step in. So I stepped in temporarily, and I loved it. It was just the best thing. I found my calling.
Last spring, though, the job of guidance counselor became endangered because of budget cuts. Miami-Dade was looking at more than a $200 million deficit. With declining revenues, the state of Florida withdrew funding for all of the district's nearly 700 guidance counselors.
We were surprised when it was all going down. Obviously, we were getting ready for graduation and getting ready for next year's course selection. Last thing I was worried about was my job.
Miami-Dade Superintendent of Schools, Alberto Carvalho, says while the state was taking the money away, it encouraged districts to replace it by applying to the federal stimulus program. Carvalho says, as far as he's concerned, guidance counselors are indispensable.
We were not going to sacrifice these people. They are as important
as a support system to kids in schools as the classroom teacher is.
Miami-Dade County schools are receiving more than $300 million in federal stimulus money over 2 years. Even so, with declining revenue from the state and from property taxes, more cuts were needed. But Miami-Dade avoided having to lay off hundreds of teachers, something that happened in neighboring Broward County. Carvalho says he was able to avoid teacher layoffs by cutting administrative positions.
400 individuals, in essence, went from either central office to the street or to the classroom, the vast majority of them to the classroom. The one area that we absolutely did not impact were the schools.
What Carvalho is concerned about now is what happens in 2 years when stimulus money is no longer available. Without additional funding from state and federal sources, he worries that the massive cuts avoided so far in Miami-Dade County may yet come to pass. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Tight budgets are not the only problem for schools this fall. They are also preparing for a return of swine flu. Kelly Weiss of Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, California, reports on one school's efforts to keep the virus at bay.
Melinda Wilson has been a teacher at Folsom High School near Sacramento for almost 20 years. And now she's asking for new supplies to stock her classroom.
This year, I'm adding to the list bottles of Purell for the kids.
Wilson wants the hand sanitizer because of the new H1N1 virus that hit in the spring. Plus, she has a different cleaning regimen.
I was in getting my room ready and spent 2 days scrubbing down all the surfaces, all of the desktops. And my TAs, who used to do that when they had time, it'll be one of their weekly chores.
Down the hall, as part of a routine exam, veteran nurse Marianne Delaney takes a student's temperature.
All right, so let's put this under your tongue and lift your tongue up. Okay, close your mouth. Thank you. Oh, you feel like you might be a little warm.
A freshman girl says she has a stomach ache. Delaney asks the student if she has asthma, and in fact, she does.
Well, kids with asthma really need to be real careful. You know, we're in the midst of looking at swine flu virus, right? So if you become short of breath or you have difficulty breathing or your asthma gets really bad, you'll want to see your physician, okay?
Since April, this school district has seen a number of confirmed cases of swine flu. One actually surfaced on the first day of school earlier this month. Delaney says this is another sign it's a novel flu virus.
We are concerned that the virus itself may mutate and become more severe this fall. We don't know what's going to happen with it. And in that case, we need to be prepared for the worst-case scenario.
Administrative assistant Sherry Graston watches students walk to their next class. Her son, Dylan, is a junior here. She says she's not caught up in the hype about swine flu, even though her son's at high risk of getting the virus. And how's Dylan feeling?
He is aware of it, and teachers are talking about it. So I feel really good about that.
So it's on the radar of the kids, but you don't get the sense from your son that he's really scared about it.
No. He's real nonchalant, real casual about it.
But Graston says not so casual, that he's not using that hand sanitizer popping up in all the classrooms. For NPR News, I'm Kelly Weiss.
Even if Arthur Frommer decides to skip Arizona, hundreds of thousands of folks will still visit the Grand Canyon this year. According to Forbes, it's the 20th most visited place in America. Number three on that list is the National Mall in Washington, D.C. And perhaps its most glittery attraction is the Hope Diamond at the National Museum of Natural History. Jeweler Harry Winston donated that blue gem to the museum 50 years ago, and to mark the occasion, the Smithsonian will temporarily reset the stone in a new design. We visited the diamond this past week with the museum's gem curator, Jeffrey Post.
This, of course, is the famous Hope Diamond.
This is the famous Hope Diamond.
Tell me a little bit about how this diamond got to be here at the Museum of Natural History.
Well, the Hope Diamond was a gift to the Smithsonian Institution and therefore to the American people from Harry Winston in 1958.
Jeweler
in New York. And after the death of Evelyn Walsh McLean, a woman who lived here in Washington, D.C., and the last really private owner of the Hope Diamond, Harry Winston bought the diamond from her estate in 1949. And in 1958, he decided that the United States should have a great national gem collection. And Harry Winston was fond of saying, well, we don't have a king and queen, but we should have our crown jewels.
There's a lot of mythology around this diamond. Some of it seems quite odd. I mean, some of the people who have come into contact with the diamond have have found themselves either dead a few years later or in accidents. It's called The Curse, right?
Well, the curse is certainly one of the fun parts of the mythology, the stories associated with the Hope Diamond. And it seems that the whole story of a curse developed about the time that Pierre Cartier was trying to get Evelyn Walsh MacLean interested in buying the diamond. And she was known to be interested in diamonds or other pieces of jewelry that had stories, that had histories associated with them. So it's pretty clear that Pierre Cartier, if he didn't completely make up the story, certainly greatly embellished the story to get her interested. And then Evelyn Walsh MacLean's life itself started to add some fuel to that fire, in the sense that even though she was a very wealthy woman, you know, the queen of the social scene here in the eastern part of the United States, very well known, despite her wealth, she had a lot of unhappiness in her life. One of her sons was killed at an early age in a very unusual automobile accident. Her daughter committed suicide. Her husband ended up in an insane asylum. And she died a relatively unhappy woman at a fairly early age. And so for people who like to believe in bad luck and curses, well, you look at, here's this wealthy lady and all these terrible things happen to her. Well, it must be the diamond. And so the story just goes on and on and on.
You guys have decided to reset this diamond.
We've sort of decided on a theme for this anniversary of allowing our public to see the diamond in a new way, or to see it in ways they've never seen it before. First of all, we're going to take the diamond out of its setting, the historic setting that we have it in now, and we're going to display it for several months just as the diamond.
Just as the diamond.
Just as the diamond.
In this case, same
way. As one of my colleagues likes to refer to it, the naked diamond.
You know? Wow. Just,
and so
when was the last time it was seen that way?
It's never been shown publicly that way.
Wow.
In fact, it's only been very rarely we've ever taken it out of its setting. And so this will allow people a chance to see the diamond itself. And starting next spring sometime, we'll put that diamond in that new setting on exhibit here for 6 months or so. And then at the end of that time, it'll go back into its original historic
setting.
Into
the Cartier setting.
Back into the Cartier setting, and it'll be seen as it always has been seen.
Jeffrey Post is curator of the National Gems and Mineral Collection at the National Museum of Natural History. Dr. Post, thanks so much for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for coming over and visiting us.
And you can see pictures of the diamond and find out how you can vote on which temporary setting you think the diamond ought to be in at thenewnpr.org.